good afternoon. Two announcements, which I'll reiterate one at the end. First, that the shiur is dedicated for a refuah shlema, a speedy recovery for Yitzchak Aryeh ben Riva Leia. And second, the announcement that I'll recap at the end. The next Tuesday, the day after Shavuos, there will not be a class. People should still learn, but between this week preparing for Shavuos and then not having any time afterwards to prepare the class, I won't be ready. So a week from today. So what's that? The 26th. Yeah. You are more than welcome to come to the shul. You are more than welcome to sit here. But yes. Maybe they'll leave me coffee unless they notify the office that there's no class. Good thought. Okay. We are... I think we are... in Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, I actually wonder, you know what, I didn't do it. No. Ha. I didn't print down my notes from chapter 17. I'm going to wing it. Because we didn't finish it last time, but somehow in my head I thought that we did. So, we are in Perek Yud Zayin. That's okay. We'll see how okay it is, but we are in Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17. And looking at, this is the second half of his response to Eliphaz. As his response began, he started in his traditional way, right? His traditional beginning to a response to any of the speakers, as we saw in the beginning of Perek Hetzayin, in the beginning of chapter 16, was to say, I've heard all this before, what you're offering isn't helpful. He had a new element in which he said, if I were in your shoes, I would be sympathetic, even empathetic, I would join with you. That was at least one way to take his statement to them. He talked about how he has suffered and how people have taken his suffering as a demonstration of his guilt. We talked about the trial by ordeal. And then he turned to talk about what God is doing to him. And he imputed not only a violence to God, saying that God is harming me actively, but also a will. He said that God hates him. He has depicted God as his enemy. And I think we talked about that last time, what it means for a person to identify God as an enemy, right? That was last time? We're good? We did that? Okay. I don't remember at this point. We then talked about how God has destroyed his body, as well as how God has depressed him. And that was the end of chapter 16. And he claimed, I am innocent, I call out for justice. He used terms at the end of chapter 16 that we associate with litigation specifically, edut, sahadi, which is another term often found in Aramaic for witnesses. He called upon heaven and earth to be his witnesses. He said, "Bashamayim edi, my testimony is in the heavens." So but on the other hand, he said he referred to the aretz as well, to the earth. Eretz atachasidami, the earth should not cover my blood. And that brought us to Perek Yud Zayin, to chapter 17, in which he speaks of his suffering. Ruchi chubala, my spirit is crushed. Yamai nizachu, my days are cut short. And he said, Simana arveni imach, mihuli adi itakeya. He asks, who will be my guarantor? And I think that was the last bit that we had done. Without my notes to tell me, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that was... Sorry, sentence three. The main piece that we had done there was this idea that he feels like he's going to expire and therefore he needs somebody to continue on his behalf.
Chapter
Excellent.
First chapter.
Okay, great, thank you. At least somebody is. If I'm not, somebody is. In sentences 5, 6, and 7, he used the image of his eyes in particular. And his eyes are not only physical eyes, but they express hope, looking to the future. He talked about, on the one hand, his enemies. In sentence 5, he said, these people who call flatterers their friends, and how their children will not have any hope. Their eyes will be ruined. It means they don't have hope. And then in sentence 7, Vatecha mikas eini, he says, my eyes have become weak from anger. And again, the eyes are the expression of hope. And that brought us to Pasuk Chet, sentence 8. And in sentence 8 he says, Yashomu Yesharim al Zos, Vinaki al Chanef Yis Orar. He says, those who are righteous, Yashomu. Yashomu is an expression of Shimama, of destruction, but it means to be silenced, to be outraged, to be upset by this. Vinaki al Chanef Yis Orar, the one who is innocent, the one who has not done this, should be aroused against the chanef. Chanef is a term we've used before in Iyov. We've noted it's a term associated with general wickedness in this book. Even though generally we say chanef means somebody who's a flatterer, that's not necessarily the point here, as much as just saying somebody who's innocent should be upset at this, should be outraged at this. V'yochez tzadik darko. And he says, one who is righteous will grab his path, meaning will be righteous, will pursue righteousness. One who is of pure hands, Yosef Ometz, will increase strength. The statement that he's making here is, as Dot Mikra sees it, a little bit of a response to Eliphaz, because Eliphaz says, you know, you're encouraging people to be corrupt, you're encouraging people not to be moral, because you're saying that there's no reward for it, and so on. Now he's saying, no, that absolutely is what I encourage. I encourage righteousness. Ve'ulam kulam tashuvu ubo'u na v'loim tzabachem chacham. But he says, all of you, I don't find anybody who is wise among you. And he's turning to his visitors and these people who have arrived, and he's saying, I see nothing from you. And so he says, as he begins his last portion of this chapter in this response, yeah.
Here it says that verse 9 is the most difficult, the part where it says, yet the righteous hold his way. Most difficult part in the whole Bible. What makes it more difficult than anything else we've done here that I think is really.
Well, I think what they're bothered by is how it fits with what came before. In other words, essentially, what I think they're suggesting there, and I don't know, that's the Sansino?
Yeah.
Okay. What I think they're suggesting there is that they agree with Eliphaz. Which is, if Job is serious in his claim that there's no justice, if Job is serious in his claim that people who do good are going to suffer and get zapped anyway, whether because the stars are in control or whether because God punishes them too finally, whatever explanation you wish to give, then why would Job want to encourage somebody to follow a good life? I think that's what's bothering them. But to me, the answer is clear. Job doesn't believe that you do what's good in order to be rewarded. He's outraged and he's angry because there is such corruption in this world, not just the corruption that he's associating with the way God runs the world, but also corruption among human beings. He's been angry at the wicked all along. That's part of why his friends think it's appropriate to tell him, you know, wicked people are going to be punished. Job is very upset. The sentence 5 that we just read, he doesn't have any patience for flatterers. He doesn't have any patience for people who flatter God, thinking to be rewarded by it. He's already said in his previous speech, when he responded to Tzofar, he said, all of you have created this false image of the way God works because you think it's going to curry favor with him and get him to like you and reward you. Job, to my mind, is being very consistent when he makes his statement here in sentence 9 that people should be righteous. Yeah.
That's a really Like, if you hear that, don't you think highly? Like, I'm thinking of the three friends, hearing him say, you know, we don't do good things just to do good things. We for reward, we do good things because we believe in being a good person.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't that sway them at some point?
Well, one of the questions in general in this book is, why doesn't anybody sway anybody? Right? I mean, they're all yelling at each other, but right. No one's listening. In that case, that's the primary reason why they keep, with each speech, they become progressively angrier.
Because they really aren't listening to what they're saying in the first place.
Well, I think that a lot of what drives it is what we said from Newsom a couple of weeks ago, which is they're working with their visions of the way the world works. And no matter what you're going to say, whether you're arguing from logic or from experience, you're not going to change their vision of the way the world works.
So they have to set again.
Everything is within that lens.
And does Joe, can I hear something like that? It's really so
admirable. Yeah, no, it's a good thing for him to be saying. We like the fact that he's saying it. But yeah, it's not going to win the day. It's not going to get them where he wants them to go. Nothing that he has, not to blow the ending, but nothing he's going to say to them is going to actually change them. It's debatable whether even God coming in to debate with them is going to change them either. This is who we are, this is what we think, and this is what we're going to keep on telling Job. And our solution to Job not understanding, because if he doesn't accept, it means he must not understand us. Our solution to him not understanding is the same thing as the solution that you have when you're speaking to somebody in a foreign country and they don't understand your language, right? We're just going to speak louder. Because surely that's going to convince them.
Yes.
So that's going to explain everything. And now they'll understand me.
Yes, I think you're being self-kick. Like,
teachers
think
they're
going to
understand.
Yeah. Yes.
In literature, until the 16th century, characters just represent...
I'll repeat it.
Yeah. Characters just represent certain texts and certain ways of thinking. And this is consistent.
That's interesting.
They're not going to evolve and they're not going to change. They're there to represent something.
Professor Sakin suggests that in literature before the 16th century, you don't see characters evolve. A character represents a type and will speak the voice of that type throughout the text. So I'm not sure that reflects biblical characters, meaning that the people we find in the Torah do evolve. Noach being, an easy example of somebody who evolves and changes. But others also. We find Moshe, through the course of the Jews' period in the wilderness, is using different methods and reflecting different ideas.
The Torah is a unique...
Right, but this is part of that.
I think this reflects the other rather than...
It's an interesting idea, for sure.
There's a Chazal that Moshe wrote here.
Yeah, so no, that was...
Apropos example, if you look at what he's writing here, it has a very different ending than him going to Har Sinai doing the Torah. Right? So I don't think he really could anticipate that good. He anticipates a good, right? He gets a happy ending, but...
Well, he gets an ending that's better than being in misery and pain. I'm not sure I would call it a happy ending.
Double everything. I mean, it's like saying...
Double everything. Double everything, but none of the children he had before. Right? I mean, I'm sorry. I have a hard time with the words happy ending and Job. But in terms of where we are here, at least in terms of what we're reading at this stage, I understand why the Sansino would say verse 9 doesn't seem to reflect his complaints. He shouldn't be encouraging righteousness, but I don't think that they're correct. Yeah. No, but when I have my notes in front of me at home, God willing, I'm going to add whatever I'm forgetting to say here. I'll email out, and that way you'll have that. But if you take a look now at what he does in sentence 11, he begins the last part of his response, in which he speaks to just how bad things are, as well as the lack of hope that he is feeling. He says, Yamai Avru, My days have passed. Yeah, I don't have the Stone Tanakh, so I can't tell you what page, but it's going to be 1630-something. 1640-something. Okay, 1640. Thank you. Sentence 11, chapter 17, sentence 11. He uses the same meter that he used in sentence 1 in the same chapter, which is an unusual meter for Job. It suggests a gasping from his suffering. In sentence 1, he said, Ruchichu bala, yamayin izachu, kvarim li. You can hear it, even if you don't speak the Hebrew, you can hear it. My spirit is wounded, he said, my days are cut off or crushed, they are graves for me. In sentence 11, Yamai avru, zimosai nitku, morashe levavi. It's the same feeling, and even the yamim, the reference to yamim is the same as well. He says, my days have passed, zimosai nitku. The word zimosai is a very interesting word. I would suggest, the Dan Mikra suggested it is his connections. His connections have been severed. You could also render zimotai legitimately as plots, like Edim Zomamim, my plans. My plans have been cut off. Morashe levavi. This is a different type of a kesher, a different type of a connection. Often the term morish is a term for a rope or a rein, like on a horse. So he's saying the ropes of my heart have been severed. I don't know if he means the blood vessels or something else, but he's saying that everything about him has really been severed. Laila leyom yasimu, sentence 12. They turn night into they. They, who is they? Who is the they who turns his night into day? His friends, his visitors. They turn night into day. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Really?
Day is good, usually.
It's a good thing. That's normally a good thing.
Nobody was suffering. At night, at least he said he got some peace if he slept a bit, but days were always horrible for him throughout this book.
Yeah. So that's the question. What does he mean, turning night into day, if you took it out of Job and just said it in general, turning night into day is a nice positive thing. So we have to find the negative here, because we know he's not a fan of his friends. That would make this the hardest sentence. So turning night into day, what does that mean? Hold on. Just, or karov mipnei choshech, the light is near in the face of darkness. So again, what does that mean? Yes?
Well, maybe they're distorting the reality and what's really happening to Job, and describing it in a positive way, which in fact is a negative thing.
Right. Right. So one way to look at it is, in fact, and this is Don Mikra's approach, is to say they're claiming that night is day. They're trying to tell me that black is white. They're telling me that my suffering is actually a good thing. They're claiming that night is day, and it's nonsense. It's just not true. However, if you look at your translations, do your translations render this as they turn night into day? They say that night is day? Change night into day? So they're reading it that way. Mitzudat David renders it differently, because he also can't accept this read. If you take a look at source number 1 on your sheet, Laila leyom yasimu, rov hamachov yivalbelu machshavosai, v'yasimu atali chashuchim v'ne'elamim kecheshchat halayla, es hadrim hamavuarim v'niglim ko'or hayom. He says, they doesn't refer to the visitors. They refers to the pain that he's suffering. The pains, plural, I suppose. But what he says is, Laila leyom yasimu should be read as Laila liyom yasimu, meaning night they turn day into. You follow? It's a very poetic read of the Hebrew. The night, the day they turn into, is the best I can do with it, trying to render it linearly into the English. It's as though it's saying they're turning day into night. They darken the day. Exactly. That's the way that Mitzudat David reads it. And he says, the machov, the pain that I am experiencing, confuses my thoughts and darkens and hides everything, like the darkness of night hides that which had been clear and wonderful. That's the way that he reads it, because he has such trouble with this clause of Laila Layom Yasimu, and Or Karov, the second half of the sentence, Or Karov Mipnei Choshech, the light that had been near, they chase away because of the darkness. And again, his they is the pain and the suffering, not the visitors. You could just as easily apply it to the visitors. He chooses not to. But you could just as easily do the same thing and say it's the visitors, and these visitors are the ones who are turning day into night, and they are darkening that which had been bright. Susan?
This is a very interesting. It's always darkest before the dawn, and that there is something going to happen in the future that will change the darkness to light.
That's really odd for someone to put into Job's mouth.
I understood.
I just can't see how. I can't see how he would be saying that and where that would fit into his words. I know it would fit into his words in the sense that he says, light
the
is...
The friends tried to persuade the Job said that the light of prosperity will soon succeed by present.
Ah, okay.
Light here in the face of darkness.
Good. Okay, now that I can see. In other words, the way to read this sentence would be the first approach that we had, that what he's doing is he's quoting them. They claim that night is day. They claim it's always darkest before the dawn. But, and then he's going to give you his, you know, rejection of their statement as we continue. He says in Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13, we're now going to get a series of words in sentences 13 and 14 that refer to the grave and to decay. Im akavesh ol besi, b'choshech ripatiti yitzuai. He says, if I will have any hope, he says, Sheol, the reference to the grave, will still be my home. And in the darkness, I make my bed. The Lashachas Karasi Aviata, to the darkness I say, not to the darkness, Lashachas is destruction. To the destruction I say, Aviata, you are my father. Imi Vachosi Larima, I say of Rima, of decay, you are my mother, you are my sister. This is a standard type of a reference in Tanakh for one who is close, calling them your, you know, parents, calling them your sibling. Think of the verse Emor la chachma achosi at, say of wisdom, you are my sister. What he's saying is, you want to know what my family is? My family is destruction. My family is decay and deterioration. That's all I have, he says. There is no such thing as hope. Notice the word that he used in sentence 13, that reiterating, recurring word for Eov of tikva, hope. Im akaveh, if I will hope, and then you see it twice in sentence 15. V'aye efo sikvasi, where is my hope? Where is my tikva? V'sikvasi mi yishurena, who can see my hope? Where is this? I have none. And so he concludes, sentence 16, Badei Sheol Teradna, they will descend to Sheol, to the depths, to the grave. Im Yachad Al Afar Nachas, and the im, as in if, is difficult to render here. I remember having trouble with this. But what he says is, they all go down to the dirt, to the dust, together. Everything is going to collapse into the dust, into the grave. And that is it. As far as he is concerned, he has no hope. He has no future. All is darkness before him. And that's his, you know, happy ending, his response to Eliphaz. I gave you a table on the sheets in which I wanted to show you the way Eliphaz's first speech and Job's reply works, and then Eliphaz's second speech and Job's reply works. His first speech, Eliphaz first said to him, you know, people deserve their suffering. If something's happening, it's because they've done something wrong. Outrage is foolish and pointless. You should be turning to God for your assistance. To which Job said, first of all, I never asked for your help, and the help you're giving me isn't helpful anyway. You remember that. It was a while ago, but Job is memorable. He said, in terms of telling me that people deserve their suffering, God is hurting me, or allowing me to be hurt if you take the idea that the stars are running the show, and I don't deserve it. As far as telling me outrage is foolish, I am angry because God has made me so. It's not my fault. And as far as turning to God for help and the idea of the hopeful narrative that things can be good in the end, I don't have any hope that things are going to be better in the end. I am going to turn to God, but not the way you want me to. I'm going to turn to God in defiance and in outrage. That was all the first round. So Eliphaz now comes back to him and says, first of all, you wickedly deny the value of goodness. You're going to lead people astray, in fact. Job, you are arrogant. You claim that you can judge. To which Job's reply on both scores is, you have no business judging me. Right? Don't judge me. Don't distance yourself from me the way that a judge does. Eliphaz said, the wicked suffer psychologically and they lack a future. Job does not really respond to this. Job never says that the wicked don't suffer. That he does not say. In some places he even indicates that he believes they do. That they, in fact, their children are going to have nothing because the parents were these flatterers and so on. Job does not disagree with the idea that wicked people suffer. However, he adds the element of God as his enemy. He adds the element of his own suffering and his demand for justice, which Eliphaz did not really address. Which means that effectively what you have here is two people talking past each other, or four if we want to invite the other friends in. They're talking past each other. Eliphaz is insisting there is justice as evidenced in the suffering of the wicked, and Job does not deny the suffering of the wicked. But he isn't interested in that as a demonstration of divine justice. And Job is arguing, I am suffering unfairly, I demand justice from God. And Eliphaz really isn't responding to that, unless you're going to say his statement that Job is arrogant is his response to that. But you don't really see a direct give and take within this. And that's just emblematic of the fact that they're not really interested in what the other has to say. They're interested in getting the other one to accept what they're saying. That's really what they're trying to do. You can see it. As Job is speaking, Eliphaz is calculating what he's going to say in speech number three. That's the sad truth of what's going on. Toby, you had something? No. Okay. Which brings us to Bildad. The speech of Bildad, and again, I'll email out other thoughts from the end of chapter 17 if I have them in my notes once I have them in front of me. Bildad. So, in order to begin Bildad's speech, which is chapter 18, it's just a one chapter speech. We recall what he did in chapter 8. Bildad, we said, was younger than Eliphaz based on the fact that he was going second. We've talked about that and the role of age in the speaking order through earlier in the book. He speaks more sharply than Eliphaz does, and that will be carried through here as well. He speaks with greater brevity. He's shorter. He doesn't have the flowery language, although he does have use of metaphors, and he has some nice use of words for their sounds. That we'll see in this chapter. We saw that in chapter 8 as well. Like Eliphaz, he refers to received authority in chapter 8 in his first speech. We aren't going to see that so much here. Bildad's philosophy is that he is concerned with defending divine justice. He did that back in chapter 8, and he's going to do it here as well. His emphasis will be that wicked people suffer, because that's the theme of this whole second round. We're going to see it here too. Whereas Eliphaz believes that everything is just, Bildad does believe, in chapter 8, we aren't going to see it as much here, but in chapter 8 he was emphatic, as we read it, in the idea that a person might suffer and be paid back in the end for what they had to endure. In other words, with Eliphaz, sin precedes punishment. With Bildad, when someone suffers, it may not be punishment for a wrong. It may be that God is making them endure something in order to help them later. That could be another reason why someone has to go through something. Bildad is a very jarring friend. so to speak, in the sense that back in chapter 8, in sentence 4, he seemed to assert that Job's children had sinned. Right? It was actually fairly clear that he was saying that. He also seems to claim that Job has sinned. In chapter 8, it's sort of a hint. Here it's stronger when he talks about the wicked suffering. Although he concluded in chapter 8 that, you know, by the way, I'm on your side, and I'd like to help you, which was a nice ending. Here, what we're going to see is essentially a two-part speech. The other thing to remember from his first speech, just because we want to recall what he has done, is remember that he used the plant metaphors. He talked about the tree being uprooted and then being planted elsewhere and flourishing more than it did in the first place. And he had this lush plant that is being supported, that he envisioned as the plant that God is taking care of. The plant metaphors were important for him in chapter 8. So here, it's really a two-part speech. The first four verses are a rebuke. Now, when I say that he is rebuking, we assume, who is he rebuking? Job. However, there is another read of this opening segment, which is really interesting and kind of out of the box. So the first four verses are a rebuke. We have to see who exactly is the receiver of this, who's the recipient of the rebuke. And then the rest of the chapter, sentences 5 to 21, are statements about wicked people suffering and disappearing and having no future. That's more or less where he's going. And as I said, there's no real, you know, ornate language here. There are no big metaphors to carry the chapter. There is some interesting wordplay. Although there is one element that is added here that Newsom is going to highlight for us at the end of the chapter, which I totally would have missed. But once you see what she says, you see it very clearly. It's something called a merismus. And if you feel bad about not knowing what a merismus is, don't feel bad. I didn't know either until she actually cited it, and then I looked it up. But it's something that's very interesting in terms of some of the verses we're going to see here in the chapter. Why? We'll see when we get to it. Well, if you want, you can take a look at source number 12 where she's going to mention it. But I think you'll still need to look it up. Yeah. Sort of. Sorry? I don't know. Right, so no, it's not the same then.
Usually they don't use
two words. Yeah. We'll see it. It'll be clear once we get there, God willing. But the two questions that I want to emphasize here are the following. First of all, Bildad will not present here the message of hope that he did in chapter 8. In chapter 8, he had this idea of turn to God and things can be better. Sometimes people suffer in order for things to improve. That is not here. You will not see that in this chapter. And so one question that we have to address is the question of why Bildad loses his message of hope. If you ask me at this point, he loses his message of hope simply because he's fed up. Right? Keep in mind, he hasn't just had Job respond to him. He's heard Job respond to Eliphaz. He's heard Job respond to Zophar. He sees they're not getting anywhere. And so he's frustrated with Job's stubbornness. And maybe that's why he's, you know, I've had enough of offering you hope. Another possibility is he's come to believe that Job is so rotten that in fact there is no hope. Maybe he thinks that it's the end of the line for Job. There really is no redeeming Job at this point. But that's one question, is why has he lost his message of hope? And then the other question is, does Bildad break any new ground? Eliphaz already spoke of the suffering of the wicked. Is there anything within Bildad's words that is going to actually break new ground in this regard? And I believe the answer is yes, but we have to see. Okay, so we know our mission going into this chapter. Now, I should also add, Malbim has a completely different read of what's going on in this chapter, which means I'm not really going to quote him in this chapter. Rather than cause confusion, because it's an entirely different read. It's a fascinating read. He reads this chapter as a debate about the survival of the soul after death. It's a fascinating read, but it would just so totally confuse everything that we're doing here that I can't bring myself to torture you in that way. We have enough torture here. So let's see what he does. Opening section here, sentences 1 to 4. Vayan Bildad HaShuchi Vayomar, the classic introduction, right? Bildad the Shuchite declares and says, Ad ana tisimun kinsei lemilin, tavinu ve'achar nedaber. How long will you place kinsei to words? Understand and then we will speak. So first of all, what's a kinsei? So this is one of those hapax words, one of those words that you will not find elsewhere in Tanakh, and so you have to ask, so how do we analyze such a word? And in this case, we have a little bit of help in the sense that we are familiar from the languages of the ancient Near East with the idea of a nun that sometimes appears in the middle of a root and sometimes does not. And so if you drop the nun, you can read the root. Kates. Kates is?
An end.
An end. Exactly. Kin se lemilin, an ending to words. How long are you going to keep on cutting off people's speech, not listening to what they have to say? And that fits with the end of the sentence. Tavinu, you will understand. Vachana daber, and then we will speak. If you want an example of it from more familiar Hebrew, what is the word in Hebrew for a man?
Ish.
What is the word in Hebrew for men, plural? Anashim. You got the nun there. And there are many other cases that you can bring as an example of it. It's not the main topic right now. But the point is that you read it as Kate's. How long are you going to keep on ending people's words? Understand, and then we will speak. So who does it sound like he's talking to? Job, right? Because that's what Job keeps doing, and that's who Bildad is angry at. And that will be a simple read, if not for one problem. Read the sentence, please, and let me know why it's difficult to render this as talking to Job. Lashon Rabin, right, he's speaking in the plural. Who's he talking to in the plural? Right? That's the problem. So let's continue reading sentences 3 and 4 and then come back to the sentence. Madua nechshavnu chabehema. Why are we thought of as animals? So it's very clear now. It sounds like he's talking to Job and saying, Job, you think we're just dumb animals who can't understand anything. Nitminu be'einechem. We are sealed up. Sorry?
Plural again.
Yes, we are sealed up in your eyes, but your is plural in the Hebrew. Be'einechem. Toreif nafsho be'apo. This is a very interesting phrase. Toreif nafsho be'apo, one who tears himself up in his anger. Halema'ancha te'azav aretz. Should the land be abandoned for you, because of you? Ve'etak tzur mimekomo, and the tzur could be read as boulder or could be read as God. Right? Should move mimikamo from its place. So sentence 4 is going to require a lot of discussion before we get to sentence 4. Sentence, even though that's part of this rebuke, we need to understand sentences 2 and 3. Who is he talking to when he says this? So Dat Mikra takes it the way that we took it on instinct, which is he's talking to Job. Take a look, please, at source number 2 on your sheet. Heitev chara lo leBildad. Bildad is good and angry. And here Amos Chacham in his commentary draws on the end of Sefer Yonah, the book of Jonah. Heitev chara lach. Right? When God says, is it good that you're angry, or are you good and angry to Jonah? So he says, Heitev chara lo leBildad. Bildad is good and angry. Al she'eyov omid bedato ve'eno mevater klum. Because Job maintains his position and gives no quarter. Hey, we're talking to you, Job. Right? We keep talking. Why aren't you changing your mind? Right? Because that always works. How often, how much more do we need to speak in order to change your mind? So which the question then is, so why are you speaking in the plural? So Dad Mikra suggests that it's because in the previous chapter, in sentences 8 to 10, Job said that the righteous would support him when he said, Yashomu Yasharem al Zot, the righteous should be upset, should be floored by the way that I am suffering. You know, they would be on my side. And in sentence 9, he said, the righteous will follow their path, meaning not the path of the friends. They're going to take my position. So he's addressing those people, these imaginary righteous people who Job says would side with him, and he's speaking in the plural to them. That's a very difficult read of the plural. I have difficulty sustaining that read. Malvin takes it similarly in this vein. Although he says, it's very funny. Did I actually bring it? Yeah, I did bring this one. Take a look at source number 3. I brought it almost to, well, take a look, you'll see. The Malbim writes, HaMidvakeach al pi ha-seichel v'ha-ra'ayot Yechale ha-vikuach im ha-ra'aya ha-achrona or Yechale ha-vikuach im ha-ra'aya ha-achrona v'ha-mofet ha-tzodek ha-machria. He says, when people debate using intellect, bringing proof to their positions, so when you finally bring a good argument, a good proof, that ends the dispute. At that point, it ends. And then the debate will end. But somebody who debates with words, just continually talking, without proving anything, so he wants to put an end to the debate with his words, with his speech. He says, somebody who just says, I'm going to talk until I've exhausted the other guy, he doesn't want to bother answering me anymore, that's not really the way to do things. It's appropriate to understand and then speak. So Malvim sees it also as a knock on Job, or a rebuke to Job, saying to him, you think that you can just talk us to death. Why don't you understand what we're saying and have a conversation, and you should debate properly. He doesn't explain the plural piece of it here. But that's his response to Job, is you should be arguing with logic. You should be hearing our proofs and responding. The weakness in this is I haven't seen so many proofs in their conversation. Right? I haven't seen them responding to Job on point either. But that's his take of this rebuke. But Mitzudat David takes this a different way. He says that Bildad is actually turning to the friends and speaking to them. In source number 4, how long will you arrange statements, meaning your statements, and put an end to words? This is what you should do. Turn your hearts to understand what Job is saying. Pay attention to what he's actually arguing about. And then we will speak to respond to them. It's a novel idea, right? We've reached chapter 18 before we suggested this. Listen to what he has to say, and then we'll be able to respond on point, and what we say will actually suit. I love what Mitzudat David is doing, in the sense that it actually makes Bildad sound a little better in what he's saying. The weakness of it is you don't really see it reflected in Bildad's remaining words. In other words, it's not as though we're going to be able to look at Bildad's speech and say, aha, this was finally a speech that suited what Job was saying and responded on point. So I'm not really clear about how Mitzudat David is going to follow this through in the rest of the chapter. He doesn't really seem to. But we have these two reads. One read is the approach that says that they're speaking to Job in the plural and saying, Job, you view us as animals, as sealed up. You're putting an end to our words. You're not even valuing what we're saying. Or Mitzudat David, who reads it as a rebuke to them, you should first understand Job and then respond, because otherwise, in sentence 3, he thinks us as being like animals. We are sealed up because of what you are saying, because of the way that you are approaching this. That's their take. That's Mitzudat David's take. Which brings us to sentence 4, which I think is an important verse to catch here. So even if you didn't get Bildad's introduction, you have to get sentence 4. He says, "Toreif nafsho be'apo," one who tears up himself or his life in his anger. Halamancha teyazav aretz. Should the land be abandoned for you because of you? Should the tzur leave its place? What in the world is he talking about? What can you? What sense can you make of this? Preferably without looking at a commentary on the bottom. Yeah. So according to that, Elisheva suggests that it's that it's a question of, are you going to come to me or am I going to go to you? So how would you fit that into the sentence?
Are you going to change nature? In other words, to change the nature of whatever is trees moving or stones moving. In other words, are you going to rip up your soul, change the way nature is supposed to go in order to convince us that you're right?
So if Job is really saying, if this is what Bildad is saying, that Job is trying to change nature, in what is he responding to within Job? Where has Job tried to change nature? That will be the catch. All right.
Well, if we sin, we lose the land. We lose the Eretz Yisrael, and maybe even God will leave us. So on your account, are we going to lose all that?
Right. So one way to read this is it's a purely an allegation of wickedness on the part of Job, whether it's a Jewish thing and about Israel or not. Job is guilty of sin, and by persisting in your sin, are you going to cause God to leave us, reading Tzur, as God, rather than as a rock, which is a standard read in Tanakh. God is often referred to as Tzur. The only problem that I have with that is, what do you do with the first clause in the sentence? He tears up his life in his anger, or he tears up himself, he tears up his soul in his anger.
Okay, you're a sinner, but you don't have to, in your anger, really go all out to suffer and quietly.
Uh-huh. Okay, could be. Could be. What else could we do with this? Yeah.
If it's a rebuke to Job, how does it fit with the beginning that you're proposing, which is a desire for them to understand him?
Correct. That's another of the weaknesses in Mitzudat David, meaning even Mitzudat David's approach, that the opening sentence is referred to a statement to the friends, this sentence has to be directed at Job. Everyone is in agreement there, and I think that's one of the weaknesses, because then you don't see any bridge. There's no indication of, now I'm turning to talk to somebody else. I think it's another weakness in that approach.
Is it possible, when we said God, when Joe kept saying God was his enemy, and therefore he could be referring back to what Job had said, and I did not want to say it, but
that's fine.
God had said, Job had said, God, you're my enemy, and now he's talking as Job is God's enemy, to expect your enemy to do, because you're suffering, because this is what's going to happen, because you've declared God your enemy.
So, halamancha is the key pivotal word according to you. The because of you.
Who is you?
Well, you is Job.
You could not be the other.
No, it's got to be. This has to be speaking to Job. I think you can't read this as him talking to the friends. Aside from the fact that it's singular.
He's not been critical of the friends further to the.
Right. I don't think so. Even within the view that he's criticizing the friends in 2 and 3, he's not in 4. But Susan, the. When he says, because of you should the land be abandoned, you mean because of your idea? Because of your understanding that God is acting as enemy?
Yeah, because God is your enemy, and you think God has made you suffer, you think we all, in the suffering, are going to be part of what may happen, not just to you, but to...
That's interesting. So that would be a new path for Bildad to tread. Meaning, what I'm understanding you to say is, Job, even if God is being unjust to you, do you think that means God is unjust to everybody?
And spreading this unjustice.
That's a really interesting idea. What will make it particularly interesting is it would make Bildad the only person in the book who knows what's going on. Because that is what's happening. God is being unjust to Job for the reasons that we already discussed, but not to anybody else. No one else is going to have to endure what Job is enduring. This is a one-shot deal. That would be a very interesting way to take it. I have to admit, I haven't seen anybody approach it this way. I don't think it really would fit so much with the rest of the things he's going to say to Job, but it's a very interesting idea.
You read the first part of the book.
Yeah, Bildad turned to the opening. let's take a look at a few ideas. That Mikra, Amos Chacham, as always, says this language has to fit something else. Language does not come in a vacuum in this book. People keep referring back to things that were said before, denying the idea that they're not listening, in fact. Yeah, although you can hear someone's words without actually paying attention to them. But if you go back to chapter 16, sentence 9, Job declared, Apo taraf vayistameni. When he talked about God as his enemy, right? He tore in his anger, right? And he was my enemy. He hated me. Apo taraf. It's a play on word. Now he's saying taref nafsho be'apo. 16. He's using Job's own words that were used back there. Job talked about God tearing in his anger, and now he says, Job, you're tearing yourself in your anger, but more to the point, go back now to Job's speech before that. Job's response to Tzofar in sentence chapter 14, sentence 8. Sorry, I wrote down chapter 14, sentence 8 in my notes, but I actually meant, sorry, I did not mean that. Where was it? Job had made the statement, Vitsuria atak mi makomo, earlier. And I looked it up. 18? Okay, so I just missed the letter. Yes, thank you. Chapter 14, sentence 18. Missed a digit. But Job had said, "Vitsuria atak mi makomo." There, Job was in the middle of saying that the human being is not like a tree. The tree, if it dies, something will grow out of the stump. The boulder, the mountain, when it is ground down, that's it. That was his statement back in chapter 14, sentence 18. So here, what he's saying is, one way to read this, and this is the way Da'at Mikra does it, is he's using Job's words in order to mock him. And if you take a look now that we've seen that, at source number 5, you see the way Da'at Mikra reads the response of Bildad. He says, Yisurei Iyov lo ba'u ba'akra'i. Job's suffering did not occur by chance. Ela lafi klalim kvuim. But there are fixed principles by which the world works. Shabam olam noheg. There are fixed principles in this world, and that's what caused Job to suffer. Ve'im Iyov mitzlonin al yisurav. And if Job is complaining about his suffering, harayu kimavakesh la'akor sidrei bereshit ulachzir ha'olam l'tohu v'avohu. He says, Job, if you don't like the way the world works, if you believe that these rules are wrong, effectively what you're saying is, you think everything should be uprooted. In your rage, you believe that the whole world should be uprooted. Should God leave the land, taking Tzur as God, should God leave the land because you don't like his justice? That's the way that Da'at Mikra takes it. Mitzudat David has a different read. If you flip to source number 6, he says, "V'chi al yedei tzaakatcha, because of your complaint, shetomar tzadik ata umyusara lo chamas. You say that you are righteous and that you're suffering without any guilt. You haven't committed chamas." וכי בעבור זה נחליט לומר שהארץ עזובה ביד מערכת השמיים? So should we now really come to believe, as you say, that the land is abandoned to the constellations, ויוצר נעתק ממקום העולם ולא ישגיח בו, that the Creator has left this world and isn't watching it anymore? Two different approaches. Let me explain it outside of the text, because this is important to understand. Dat Mikra says that Job, that Bildad is saying to Job, you aren't happy with the way the world works. You are outraged. As a result of your rage, should now God leave? Is that what you're saying? We should change everything? The whole world is wrong and everything is bad because you, Job, think so. These rules work. Your outrage is not sufficient that everything should change. That's the way that Dat Mikra reads it. But Mitzudat David is giving us a different slant on this. Mitzudat David is furthering the approach that says that Job is arguing that everything's been outsourced to astrology, to the stars. That Job is saying God doesn't run the show, he had left it to the stars. And the response of Bildad is, should we assume that God has left this earth? Should we assume God has left this earth because you say so? Just on your say so. In other words, should our understanding of the way the world works be shaken by your claims? It goes back to the point that we made before regarding the way people look at the world, right? Newsom's point, effectively, that we read a few weeks ago, when she said people come up with their worldview. They have their sense of the way the world works. And even if you show them something that doesn't fit, they'll say that's an anomaly that requires explanation, but it doesn't shake my understanding of the way the world works. And even if, you know, 70% of what they see doesn't fit, they're going to keep on explaining it in other ways. And they'll say that doesn't fit because this was a different situation. Something was wrong in that situation. They deserved it because of X. And so, I'm down to the last couple of minutes on this. What Bildad is saying that may be new here is maybe it's true, Job. Maybe it doesn't fit. Your life doesn't fit what we believe about the universe. But you're not going to shake our understanding of the universe and God's role here because of your personal experience. That doesn't trump the understanding that we have of the world. You can't kick God out on that basis. God remains, and we have to figure out what's going on with your story. That's Mitzudat David's way to read what Bildad is saying here. I had one last note that I wanted to show you in source number 7 that just, it's too good a phrase to miss. When Bildad begins sentence 4 by saying "Toreif nafsho be'apo," somebody who tears himself up in his rage. So source number 7 comes from the book Mesilat Yesharim. Mesilat Yesharim, Path of the Just, is a work of ethical instruction written by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato some almost 300 years ago. And in it, he talks about how a person can grow and improve within their traits, and one trait that he spends some time discussing is the trait of anger. And he uses this phrase here as part of his discussion about anger. You can see it there. I won't read it inside because we only have a minute or two left. But he talks about how people who are angry will do anything if they let themselves be controlled by their anger. Whatever their anger motivates them to do, to lash out against somebody else, to change their life completely, to move, to whatever it is. When they are angry, their anger, if they let it control them, they'll do whatever their anger says. And so what he's saying here is, to Job, one who tears himself in his rage, Tarev Nafsho Be'apo, he says, you would be somebody without any nefesh. You'd just be a beast. You'd be predatory and tear up and destroy whatever your anger told you to do. Should the world be abandoned? Is that right, Job? Is that right? Is that okay? He's borrowing Job for his purposes here, but I think it does fit in terms of Bildad's speech. In Bildad's first speech, he's not Bildad, in Eliphaz's first speech, he said, Job, it's not good to be outraged and to be upset. What he's now saying is, Job, you're letting your rage get the better of you, and it's driving you to lengths that are inappropriate. So to sum up what we've said in terms of Bildad, Bildad is either rebuking Job for not listening or rebuking the friends for not listening. You could take it either way. But either way, in sentence 4, he rebukes Job for giving in to his rage, and two ways to take it. Either he's saying, you don't like it, so you think God should leave the land? That's one way to take it. Or alternatively, he's saying, because of your personal experience, does that mean we should conclude that there is no justice here? Maybe your case is different. Your case requires discussion. Or, frankly, maybe Job, you are wicked. He hasn't said that here, but that's been a subtext elsewhere. Either way. So again, there is no class next Tuesday. We resume, God willing, 2 weeks from today. Have a good yontif.